Welcome to the second half of your second class on writing the history of the First World War. I finish with sources. There's a lot of sources, we know. That's good enough. So I now want to look more straightforwardly at the historiography. So historiography is the history of history. And I highly recommend, especially anybody who is thinking, who is doing research in civilization, a little book by Nicolas Alfredstadt, Historiographie, which is just the most wonderful book imaginable, and is non-expensive. It's €5 or €6. So what the question is, what kinds of history were written in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s? What were the new trends? What kinds of history were made? Because remember that historians do not discover history, they make it. They find new sources, they ask new questions, and this creates history. Because history is not a list of things which happened in the past. Otherwise, you could write 1,000 books about the 1st of August 1914 in one town. Wouldn't be very interesting, but it, you know, it'd be like so. So, it has been suggested by people who know more about this than I do that there are fundamentally three fields. In fact, the original is in French, and they say trois configurations, three fields of history which have been written about the First World War, and some of them are difficult to understand. When I say three fields, that is like three fashions, three methods, three groups of histories. And they arrive one at once. You get the first one, and then 20 years later the second one, and then 30 years later the third one. But when a new field arrives, the old one does not die. It continues. So basically, you have a period where there's one, and then a period where there are two of them, and then a period where there are three of them. And usually the last arrival is the one that dominates in universities, but not necessarily elsewhere. I don't know if any of you have the chaîne histoire or the chaîne toute l'histoire. C'est un programme, hein, toute l'histoire. Le slogan, c'est toute l'histoire pour ne rien oublier. Wow, c'est fatigant. But if you have these history channels on the television, half of the programmes about war. About half of them, which is rather a lot. In any case, about the First World War, the first field is military and diplomatic history. Well, I think I'll do that again. So let's have a look at what kind of military and diplomatic history have been written about the First World War and how it changed over the last 100 years then that we've been writing the stuff. So first of all, let's go for a definition. And when I want a definition, of course, I go to the Oxford Dictionary of English. And I just look, military history. The study of the role that armed forces played in past events. So it's not difficult or complicated to understand. You will see that later on they get more difficult. Yeah, so the study of the role that armed forces played in past events. Now, if you're a military historian, then you have your favourite questions. Some of your favourite questions. For example, how did mothers react to losing their sons in the war? It's not a question for the military historian. It's another kind of history. Yeah? The questions which the military historian likes is, remember, the most interesting questions are with why. Yeah? You know, why did Germany lose? Why did Germany start the war? Why did Germany lose? Why did Germany win this battle and lose this battle? Why was the tank less effective than everybody thought it was going to be? These are military history questions, which are basically about tactics, about strategy. There are 100 of them. There's not two or three, there are 100 of them. So let's have a look at them. Well, first, of the military history and diplomatic history, if they're identified by the questions that we ask, they're also identified by the kinds of sources. Of course, a military historian will not be looking at the novels of the First World War, but they could be looking at archaeology. They could be looking at military reports, maps, etc. Now, the military histories, the diplomatic histories, were written very quickly after the First World War. Here's one of them: La crise européenne et la Première Guerre mondiale by Pierre Renouvin. That's not what I was going to say. Oh, yes, yes, I know what I was going to say. And now, one of the interesting things about the military history which was written at this time, very often the money for writing the history came from governments. The government sponsored historians. They said, you know, we want a sophisticated history of the First World War. And quite naturally, one of their objectives was to justify in some ways the position of their country. Now I have here my documents, okay. So we will not be surprised to see that the history which was paid for by the French government tends to give a favourable view of French activity during that particular war. What is fascinating about this is that the experience of the ordinary soldier at this time in the 1920s is not considered to be history. Yet what happened to individuals is not considered to be history. History at the time is considered to be about what the generals decided, the tactics, the strategy. And the reason for this is that historians consider at the time that to understand the war, to understand why it happened the way it happened, individual experience is not useful. The individual soldier in the middle of the battle, what do they understand about the battle? Very little. And this can be even quite shocking, because Pierre Renouvin wrote this big book about the First World War, and he never mentioned his own personal experience. But he had been in the war, and he had been very severely injured and lost part of his body. And so this is very, very interesting. So this is the idea that what is history at this time, a whole load of things which later we consider as history are not considered to be history. So the emotions of the soldier and the experience of the soldier would be respected by the poets, but not by the historian. And there's a couple of sets of war poems which are still being published today. You know, the war poems. So, the reason that the individual soldier was not respected, or that their experience was not respected by historians, I think is also connected to the democratic spirit. Remember that Britain in 1914 was not a democratic country. 60% of men and no women could vote. So that's 30% of the population. And even when the entire population has the right to vote in 1928, nevertheless, it takes time for this to really affect the culture, I think. Now, the importance of the right to vote, it's more important than we think. Now, of course, we all think it's important that the women got the right to vote. But I think we forget today how important, because before women had the right to vote, it's not just that they didn't have the right to vote, but they didn't have the right to vote because the general opinion was they had nothing in their heads which would help them to vote. So it's much more important than the election every 5 years, and quite often we stay at home. It was actually a whole societal view of who people were. If you don't have the right to vote, it's because you're not really fully human, you know, because your ideas can't be interesting because there's nothing in your head. That's not very nice, is it? Okay, so let's see. Je sais pas ce que je m'attendais à trouver sur ça. Ah oui, voilà, okay, d'accord. Now, you still have military history being written today, but of course, obviously, if you write military history today, you need to find some new question. You can't really just write another book about the Battle of Passchendaele. When there were 10 of them written in the 1920s. And there are a number of ways of doing this. The first one is to write books about geographical areas which have not been sufficiently studied. And here's a wonderful book here, Tip and Run, The Untold Tragedy of the Great War in Africa. Of course, we normally think of the Great War, we think, oh, France, yes, Turkey. In fact, as you saw briefly in the video, there was the fight for the German colonies in Africa, and also in Egypt, tremendous amount of fighting. And there were a very large number of people killed. I don't have the numbers, but really it was a big thing, yeah. And this had been not very much studied, and this person came, oh, well, yeah, I'm a historian, I have new questions about a new place. It's also a very typical, this is a paperback book, it's a very typical paperback book, because the untold tragedy. Yeah, if you want to sell your history book, you have to have the word untold or forgotten in the story. Now, don't get carried away, because I don't think there are more than 10 people in Britain who make a living by writing history books on the First World War. It's extremely difficult to make money from history books. The history book that I wrote, that I showed you, I have made €400 so far. It's nice, but, you know, it was 5 years' work. So really, history costs money, but today it's mostly the universities who pay for it. So the university pays my salary. I am a part-time teacher and a part-time researcher. The university is paying me to write history books. This is good because, you know, €400 is not a lot for writing a book. Here is another one. Then, military operations in Egypt and Palestine from June 1917 to the end of the war. Yeah? So very detailed military history about areas that which have perhaps been less studied. Or you can write more details about particular weapons. Here is a book on defeating the U-boats. For reasons which I don't understand, I don't know, the Germans were far advanced in submarines at the beginning of the First World War, and the submarine warfare was a big element in the war. The British didn't, and the Americans didn't have very good submarines. I'm not sure why this is, and this was tremendously important. And they fought back against the submarines, first of all by different forms of bombs, but also by changing the organization. When they discovered, somebody had a new idea, a very simple idea, that this is about making sure that the ships with food come from America to Britain and France. Somebody had a very simple idea. Said, let's not send the ships one by one, let's send 100 together. Very simple idea, but that was the solution against the submarines, in fact. The convoy shipping, always going in a big group, which is something that we know in everyday life. You know, if there's some rather violent people around, oh, let's go 10 of us at the same time, you know. But it was a big thing there. One more here, a book about tanks in the Great War. Now, tanks were much more useful in the Second World War, but nevertheless, in the Great War, they were useful too. Tanks are, from a military tactician point of view, a big change, because the problem of the First World War was the level of aggressive and defensive weapons. In 1914, the best defensive weapon was the machine gun, and the best aggressive weapon, attacking weapon, was the soldier walking forward. You can see the problem. Basically, if you attack, you lose. Yeah. Once you invent the tank, which in theory and gradually in practice can advance against the machine gun, then you change the situation. But for the reason that the trenches don't move for years and years fundamentally is because of this. It's because the machine gun stops the main aggressive tactic at the time. The Indian Empire at war. Untold story again, the Indian Army in the First World War. There's a lot to be said. The Indian soldiers got to France very quickly. In fact, they were brought very, very quickly over by the British. At this time, India is a colony of Britain until 1947. And there's been quite a lot of work done at them. The British looked at the Indians, now, unsurprisingly, in a very racist way. And in particular, they thought, oh, the Indian tribes from the south of India are very peaceful. We don't want them in our army. But the Indian tribes from the north of India, they're very warlike, and so we'll recruit them into the army. This was the colonial way of seeing things. Yeah, being a colonial country tends to make you stupid and not make you intelligent. And so they have these stereotypes about the different regions of the different tribes, and that's how they recruited the people. Later military history. The new questions they were finding. Now, I mentioned that in the 1920s and the 1930s, the personal experience of the soldier was not considered to be important. However, later, it will be at the centre of military history. So this is perhaps an advance in the democratic spirit, that it's necessary to talk about the ordinary people. Remember, of course, the society was tremendously hierarchical in the First World War. If you were in the British Army, if you were injured, you went to hospital. If you were lucky, you went to hospital. A separate hospital for the officers and for the ordinary soldiers, of course. Because this was the society at the time, this was automatic, yeah, the segregation. Whereas today, if you had a separate and better hospital for the military officers and the military soldiers, that would be a scandal. The newspapers would say, we're treating our soldiers badly. At the time, there wasn't this democratic spirit. So later on, then you have more and more military history from below. So it's still military history. It's asking new questions. It's asking, you know, how did people survive in trench warfare? What was the role of sports in their lives? What was the role of killing in their lives? What was it like killing? One of the big problems they had with the memoirs is that the memoirs are full of people, are full of soldiers remembering seeing people dying. But there are almost no memoirs which remember killing anybody. Somebody must have killed somebody. That's what wars are like, yeah? But you can understand that a soldier writing his story might not mention some things which are even more traumatic, because I think in some ways killing can be more traumatic. I haven't done a lot of killing, so I can't be absolutely sure. Not yet. This wonderful book, Tommy, the British Soldier on the Western Front, 500 pages, Richard Holmes, this is one of the great historians of military history. Not a university man, not a university guy, more a guy who makes his living from writing books. Now, if you want to make your living from writing history books, military history from the below is the best option. This is what people want to read. Even in France, if you go to the bookshop in Hall, a bookshop is like a big room where they sell things with... if you go to the bookshop in Rouen, you'll find that a lot of the history books are about military history from below. Mon expérience dans les tranchées, mon expérience dans les débarquements, etc. It's very, very popular. Another one there again. This is a particular example, because this is the missing of the First World War, les portés disparus. So he's chosen a particular group who have not been much studied, so as to have a go at that. There are always new options. Yeah, you have to find new things to it. But no doubt the best military history book on military history from below is this one, Trench Warfare 1914 to 1918, The Live and Let Live System by Tony Ashworth. And what's interesting about this is he found a new question. And his new question was, what happens in the trenches when there is not a battle? Very interesting question. Yet there have been lots and lots of books written about the battles, of course, because the battles are very exciting. But then he said, well, what happens when there is not a battle? Because a typical experience would be 3 weeks of battle and then 4 months of not battle. There's a lot of the time there's not much happening, yeah? And soldiers got very, very bored. They also organised an industrial amount of football, theatre, etc. It was enormous. And what he discovered was the live and let live system. What is the live and let live system? Well, I know the example of the British and the Germans, but it's c'est une entente cordiale quelque part. That is to say, you contact the Germans saying, listen, let's not do any fighting before 10 o'clock in the morning so we can all have breakfast. This was very common. It's very, very common. Or also, sometimes they would have a pause so they could bury their dead. It was respected. They stopped the war so that they could bury their dead. But sometimes it got quite sophisticated. For example, they had agreements with the Germans, secret agreements with the Germans. They said, listen, you bomb on the left-hand side at 3 o'clock every afternoon, and we will bomb on the right-hand side at 11 o'clock every morning. So when the generals come to see, we can say, oh, look at all the bombing we've been doing. But actually, we'll all be okay. We'll all be okay. This was, again, quite common. A third example, the hierarchy came to trust the soldiers less and less. So at the beginning of the war, the decisions could be made locally of when to attack. but later on it was very centralized. And there was a time when the British Army wanted a lot of night patrols. And every night you must send 20 men in two groups of 10, and you as well. To prove that you've done it every night, we want you to bring back a bit of German barbed wire. Rapporter un peu de barbelé chaque nuit, comme ça, on sait que vous avez fait la patrouille de nuit. So, of course, what they did is they stole a big ball of barbed wire, and every day they cut a little bit off and took it to the general. So what is he discovering here is the sophistication of the soldier's mentality. Of course, the British soldiers wanted Britain to win, in general, but also they didn't want to die. One of the big questions that the soldiers were doing is, how can I avoid fighting even though I'm in the army? And of course they're very intelligent, so they found 100 ways of doing this. Those are just some of my favorite examples. There were more violent ways of doing that as well. Of course, this is one of them. Now, what am I doing? I'm trying to get a wound in my arm. Yeah? Because I have to go to hospital. In hospital, you don't get killed in hospital. That's good. Lots of self-inflicted wounds. It's quite dangerous, of course, because if you shoot yourself in the foot, it hurts, yeah. But also, it's suspicious, you know. A vertical wound in your foot, yeah, and you could be in very serious problems, yeah. Keep your head down, you know. Keep your head down. People are very intelligent. They found lots of ways to do it. So this was just an example of somebody finding a new question: what happens when there's no battle, and coming up with all this. Along the lines of military history from below, you also get the publication of a large number of diaries. Diaries and memoirs. Remember, I explained to you the difference last week. Diaries written at the time, memoirs written later. Here you have memoirs of a machine gunner on the Western Front. Now, people will want to read this because a machine gunner is a particular kind of experience. It's not just in general. You can see that to help sell it, there are holes so it's like a bit of a commercial gimmick. Yeah, that it's actually holes in the book's cover. It's a bit cheap marketing, isn't it? There you go. Mud, blood, and bullets. Yeah. Oh yeah. Mud, blood, and bullets. Yeah. More, please. Yeah. There's a slightly gory side to it. Now the machine gunners were interesting job because machine guns are quite expensive, and the later ones are even more expensive. And so you don't want to leave them in the same place all the time, because if the Germans say, "Oh, the machine gun's just there, the machine gun's just there," after 2 hours they've organised to bomb it. Yeah. And so what the machine gunners would do is they would arrive, work for an hour, and then move. They were very unpopular because they arrived here. "Oh, I've come here. Don't worry about me. I'm just going to use the machine gun for an hour. Then I'm going away." I would be very unpopular because, you know, what happens after the machine gun is gone? Lots of bombs on you, but I've gone. You know, so the machine gunners could be very unpopular. Yeah, or so this is history which deals with how people related within the army. This is the diary of a Great War soldier and artist. A private, yes, so not an officer, a low-down guy. And these are tremendous. There are many, many more. In France as well, these have taken off the diaries. They're still being published today, new ones, where people find them in their great-grandfather's belongings, you know. My Diary of the Great War. Military History from Below, diaries. One more. This is an interesting one because this is the diary of Chaplain Kenneth Best. So he's a priest. Diary of a priest at Gallipoli. The priests were in an interesting position. In France, if you were a priest, c'est la laïcité, in France, if you were a priest, you were in exactly the same position as everybody else. You're a priest, you're not a priest, you're both in the army. That's the end of it. Here's your gun. In Britain, which has always had a tremendously different view of religion, you were not made to fight if you were a priest. You were not conscripted even after 1916. You remember, volunteer army in 1914, 1915, conscription 1916, but not priests. If you were a priest, you could volunteer to become a religious chaplain, but you were not recruited into the army. Now, the story of the priest is very, very interesting, because the First World War transformed the Church of England in a few ways, which have some importance. First of all, remember, the Church of England was generally enthusiastic supporters of the war. In fact, one of their most enthusiastic bishops used to say, "This is Berlin against Bethlehem." It's got style, yeah. Or the mailed fist against the nailed hand. The mailed fist against the nailed hand. Jesus is on our side, etc. And most of them did that. Although it's true that the Church of England did not accept, did not recommend to priests to tell people to join the army. That was not accepted in the Church of England. But also, there were theological changes that came out because of the war. First of all, in the Church of England, remember, these are not Catholics, they have a different view of things. In the Church of England before 1914, it was not a tradition to pray for the dead. Because in Protestant theology, you don't ask God to do things. God can decide, you know, this is God's job. Your sister has died, and you know, maybe they're in heaven, maybe they're in hell, but it, you know, it's God's problem. Whereas in the Catholic religion, you pray, and if you do say the right number of prayers, then you know your sister will have a slightly better time in purgatory. Yes, that's how it works. But interestingly, during the First World War, the Church of England suddenly changed and said, okay, we will pray for the dead. Because the popular demand and the popular need to pray for the dead was absolutely massive. Yeah. So the religious changes because of the war. There's also another important thing about priests, and that there was a big difference between Anglican priests and Catholic priests. Remember, Catholics are 10% of the British population, approximately. Anglican priests were recruited from the elites, and Catholic priests were working class Irish or Italians. So there was actually a big social difference, and therefore a big experience with them. Sometimes the diaries are a little bit gory, and seeing as that you've come to a class on the First World War, you're expecting a little bit of gore, so here's a little bit of gore for you. Just outside the wood, we came to a well-constructed trench. In it, there's a British soldier to every yard, killed on the parapet, trying to hop off. 20 yards in front, a row of dead British soldiers in perfect line as they're on parade, NCOs in position, and a half dozen paces ahead, their platoon officer, a rusty revolver in one outstretched hand, his whistle still clasped in the other, mowed down by machine guns. We see two men, a Fritz and a Tommy, dead within a yard of each other. The Fritz has a British bayonet through his throat, while the Tommy lies doubled over a Fritz bayonet whose point protrudes from his back. Yeah, some people like to watch horror films, some people like to read history books about the First World War. Yeah, it's got a certain similarity. Now, just to stay with the question of military history today, what new military history can be imagined today? Because as I mentioned, it's not finished. There are hundreds of questions which have never been touched. And if you want to write military history today, then you can, of course, find a new area, Africa, New Zealand, or something which hasn't been sufficiently explored. Or you can write about a particular experience within the military. And here's an example. Boy Soldiers of the Great War. Same guy, Richard Van Emden. And this book is just about the youngest soldiers. How young was the youngest soldier to join the British Army, do you imagine? Would you like to guess? 13 was the youngest soldier to join the British Army. Now, at the beginning of the war, you were not allowed to join the British Army if you were not 17. So how did they join the British Army at 13? How did they manage? They just said, I'm 17. Remember, this is Britain. We don't do documents anyway. But the fundamental thing is that the recruiting officer didn't care. There are many, many stories of the, I'd like to join the army. How old are you? 15. Ah. Well, listen, just walk over there and then come back when you're 17. And so what's over there? How old are you? 17. Okay. Because the recruiting officer didn't care. He didn't care at all. But what is interesting about this is also society saw young people in different ways. You see lots of letters in the paper. We are very proud because our son, who is 14, has joined the army. And everybody knows that he lied about his age. But a lot of the parents were proud of their 14-year-olds for joining the army. Now, today, we think, oh, that's terrible, children fighting, you know. But they didn't think like that at the time. And this is one of the biggest things about history. I can't remember who said it. I think it's, I can't even remember who said it. The past is a different country. They do things differently there. And that's very, very interesting, because for a long time, we only saw that the shocking side of the boy soldiers. And when he wrote this book, he also found the letters of parents to the papers about how proud they were. So, do you have any little brothers who are 13 who you would like to send to the war? Yeah, I know the feeling. Yeah, there's somebody behind me. Yes, okay, so boy soldiers of the Great War. There's something else about this, their own stories for the first time. I think this is 20 years ago. What he did is he managed to identify in the 90s some very old men who had joined the First World War. And so he had, this is interviews, extracts from interviews with very old men about being 13 or 14 or 15 in the war. These are the ones who were not killed, who were interviewed. Fair enough, it's better that way. So this is oral history. I will be saying more about this later. This is slightly difficult, because if you interview somebody who is 87 about what happened to them when they were 14 in the war, in the First World War, there are a number of difficulties. First of all, they have forgotten things. Secondly, they can invent things. You know, when you're 87, you don't care much. I'm not even 87, and I don't care. So they might be, you know, making a story that is better than it was. So there are a number of problems, but there's also a number of interesting things about it. Boy soldiers of the Great War enters into this idea of finding new experiences. Here is one of the great military historian, one of the new generation. As I'm sure you're not surprised to hear that most military historians are men, but not all of them. Ilana Bettel wrote this book, Conscripts, Forgotten Men of the Great War. You've got to have the word forgotten here. But this is an interesting idea, because many books had been written about the volunteers in the British Army in the First World War. And it's often forgotten that the majority, well, 52%, but still the majority of British soldiers who fought in the First World War were obliged to do so by law. That is to say that during the year 1914 and 1915, there was a massive recruitment campaign. And these people said, no, thanks. No, I don't think I will. Yeah. So this tells us something about the popular enthusiasm for the war, which has been much exaggerated. Particular experiences within the military. Another particular experience within the military here, the untold story, again, untold story, yeah, of World War I's conscientious objectors. These are pacifists who refused to join the army. And a fascinating and moving book. Oh, yeah, they think so too. The fascinating story, first of all, the existence of conscientious objectors in the First World War is very much a British specificity. In France, you couldn't say this. You said, oh, well, actually, I'm a conscientious objector in the army, you know. And in Britain, they had this idea. It was possible, very difficult, but it was possible to have it recognised that you were a pacifist and you were not joining the army. Now that is fascinating. So the interesting question is, why in Britain did they allow this, and why in France did they not allow it? That's what I like as a historical question, because it begins with why. That's my favourite ones. And you will never guess the reason, because it was hard to find. And it's about religious history. that in France, France has been a Catholic country, especially at this time, Catholic country. So basically, there were a few Protestants, but you know, who cares? It was fundamentally a Catholic country. So there was one theology, one set of ideas, and one boss over there in Rome. Hello, Francis. Whereas in Britain was a Protestant country with a variety of religious positions. Indeed, even the Church of England has a lot of different religious positions inside it. You go into some Church of England churches and they look like Catholic churches with statues and decorations, and you go into other Church of England churches and they're very simple. Yeah. So the British were used to dealing with religious diversity. And one of the results of this is that it was not hard for them to recognize that some religions refuse to fight, and well, that's acceptable. And so, if you wanted to be recognized as a conscientious objector, you had the best chance if it was for religious reasons. If you didn't want to fight because you were a socialist, that was not good enough. It had to be religious reasons. There are other effects of this history of British religion has other effects for today. This has nothing to do with the First World War. In the question of Muslims in Britain. Because when many Muslims arrived in Britain 30, 40, 50 years ago, in Britain it's, we have six religions, now here's seven. So it was not complicated to do. So yeah, you know, just all do different things. And so there's been less tension and less Islamophobia in Britain than in other countries. So, wonderful story. Now, it could be very hard. So first of all, you're a conscientious objector for religious reasons. You go to the tribunal, they say yes or no. But if they say yes, you're supposed to join a non-combatant unit. You work in an ambulance or something like that. But some of the conscientious objectors said, no. The ambulances are helping the war. I refuse to go and work in an ambulance. So I refuse to kill, but I also refuse to go into an ambulance. Well, the third option was you're going to prison. And many conscientious objectors spent the war in prison. At the beginning of war, it was even harder, because the first group of 20 conscientious objectors, they said, you're in the army, you're going to France. And so they took them to France on the war. And at one point, the sergeant said, get up and get the gun. And he says, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I'm refusing. And they said, okay, took them to the tribunal. You are sentenced to death. You're going to be executed. Now, at this time, there was then a political campaign in Britain, and a few members of parliament who sympathized. There was a big campaign. They were not executed, and they were taken back to Britain for prison. But they thought they were going to be executed, you know. So very, very hard. Life got a little bit easier later. Now, strangely enough, some of the military officers were quite sympathetic, because if you're a military leader, you don't want a conscientious objection in your group. You just want soldiers, and if somebody is really going to refuse, well, they're just troubled, you know. Put him in prison. Leave him, don't send him here, you know. It's a wonderful story there. Another story about priests, padres in no man's land. Military history from below, particular groups within the military and their military experience. Another way of writing military history, I think we're only going to talk about military history today. There's a lot of it about particular experiences within the military. No, so not particular groups, but particular experiences. And here's the first one, which is not a very nice experience. And that is the experience of being executed. No fun. British military executions in the Great War. Wonderful book by Catherine Corn. So again, we're a woman military historian. There are more and more. And what they did is they analysed all the cases of British soldiers executed during the Great War by the British Army. And they discovered some very interesting things. Firstly, if you ran away, you know, you were a deserter, or if you fell asleep on the job, or killed your officers, they don't like that, funnily enough, or whatever. Then you were very often taken to a military tribunal, and very quickly you were sentenced to death. However, most people who were sentenced to death were not executed. that you were sentenced to death, and then a few days later, the boss says, okay, you know, 3 months prison, and then put him back in the army in a dangerous place. See, it's difficult in wartime because, you know, supposing that you're trying to run away, and they catch you and say, okay, right, you're not going into the army, you're going into prison. You say, oh, yeah, okay, I'm going to prison and not in the army, you know, because you're safer in prison. So quite often they gave them very short prison sentences because they wanted them in the army, not in prison. But sometimes sometimes you were executed and sometimes you were not executed, and they give something else. Now, what was the criteria that made the difference? In fact, the criteria, as they discovered, was the conduct of the war. That is to say, if the war was going well, quite positive from a military point of view, oh, don't execute them, it doesn't matter. If the war was going badly and the British Army were losing ground, say, yeah, execute them pour encourager les autres, as they say in French, yeah, to terrify the others, in fact, yeah, to intimidate the others. So, very, very hard situation, and it became a political question very recently, because for a long time, the families of the executed campaigned for a government pardon. Ils voulaient une exonération après, donc posthume, a government pardon for the soldiers executed during the Great War. And in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, the government said, well, it's impossible a pardon, the legal system has changed, it's impossible. And then a few years ago, they decided to pardon, they officially pardoned all the executed during the Great War, so obviously it wasn't impossible. One of the reasons they pardoned them all is because there were going to be court cases in the International Court of Human Rights on individuals, and the British Army preferred not to look at the details, I suspect. This has also been a debate in France. In France, there has been a campaign to pardon the fusillés pour l'exemple, as we say, and there was a debate in Parliament 2 years ago in France in 2016, and they decided not to pardon them. So that's where it is at the moment. They might eventually, but again, this is something very, very interesting, I think. Try to imagine your great-grandfather was executed by his own army. How much energy would you put into a campaign for him to be pardoned? Now, for some people, this is really, really important, the question of honour, and for other people, say, well, it's 100 years ago, he's dead, you know, I need to paint my bathroom, you know. So it's a big and interesting question. Because, of course, remember that historians are paid to ask why, and we're not paid to consider that it's because people are stupid. Yeah, it's very tempting. People do a lot of different things in life, and it's always very tempting to say, well, les gens qui font comme ça, bon, c'est des cons, c'est tout. But that's what's not allowed when you're a historian. That doesn't explain anything. Because afterwards you get the question, pourquoi ils sont cons? This one in France, in French, Les Mutineries de 1917. This was the first book about the mutineries. In 1917, there were quite a number, dozens of French regiments affected by mutinies. This has later been symbolised by the song which you may have heard, La Chanson de Khan. I'll put it on the web for you. This is a famous soldiers' anti-militarist song, which was not written in 1917, which was written before, but which later came to symbolise these mutineers who said, you know, we are fed up of being sent to die. Let's kill our officers instead. This was the first book, perhaps not the best book, but the first one. And this book, to go back to Britain, is a whole book about the Christmas truce. And again, with one woman and one man involved. The Christmas truce, I think you've heard about it, this is December 1914, when not in one place, but in 20 or 30 or 40 different places, the British soldiers and the German soldiers, this is what I know about, decided, oh, let's not fight today and tomorrow because it's Christmas. Okay. Fascinating idea. But of course, the generals were not happy. Yeah? They don't like that. Now, lots of interesting things about this. First of all, in every case, Just another 10 minutes will do it. In every case, the Germans began. In the 20 or 30 different cases, and in every case, it was the Germans' idea to stop fighting. Why? Well, were the Germans more pacifistic or more intelligent? I wondered about this for a long time, for months and months I wondered about this. The answer is very, very simple. Anybody know Germany well here at all? Tremendously simple. Two reasons. The first reason I thought of is some of the Germans spoke English and the English did not speak German. This is true, just like today. So that's one element, because of course if you're going to say, hey, I've got something to say, it's nice to be sure you'll be understood if you're in the trench. But the second reason, much more important, in Britain, Christmas celebrations begin on the morning of the 25th. And in Germany, Christmas celebrations begin on the evening of the 24th. And that's the explanation. For the Germans, it was already Christmas, and for the English, it was not Christmas yet. And so they suggested, played football, drank snaps, and drank whiskey. It became an important symbol. For a long time, people thought that this was a secret and that people in Britain didn't know about it. It's not true. In all the local newspapers, they said, oh, isn't this a funny story? There was a Christmas truce, so people did know about it. Fascinating book, really excellent book. Or, of course, you can just write a book about a particular battle. One last part of military history from below. And this is a very different approach. This whole series of books, VCs of the First World War. Anybody know what a VC is? It's a Victoria Cross. It's the highest medal that you can receive. What is it in French, like Croix de Guerre or something? You know, it's an important medal that you can receive if you're in the army. Now, to receive a Victoria Cross, you have to do something where you're almost certain to get killed. And you can receive the Victoria Cross either after you're dead or while you're still living. Now, this is very interesting kind of history because it's a lot of ordinary people. Each of these books has like 50 short biographies. So it's a lot of fairly ordinary people in general. However, it's concentrating on just those people who received this important medal for extreme bravery. So it's a very patriotic kind of history. Yeah, let's just look at the bravest soldiers, the heroes. Yeah, if you want to write a history of heroes, that's very patriotic sort of history, yeah? Because you only write about British heroes. You don't write about British and German heroes, usually. You don't normally find a book saying, British and German heroes of the First World War. Because people who think of the war in terms of heroes are usually nationalistic, because that's what heroes is about, yeah? And so these books are, in a way, I think, a way of rescuing military history from below for the nationalist discourse. So it's very nationalist, as you know. Here is a presentation of all the British heroes. So a very traditional way of seeing the war. This has led to other campaigns. Indeed, very bizarre campaigns. There was a campaign to mark the street where every VC lived in Britain. So like a little monument. And what they decided to do, you know the British post boxes, the red circular post boxes where you post your letters? Well, what they decided to do was to paint them gold in the nearest post box to where all the VCs lived. So this is a strange initiative in commemoration. We will come into commemoration later because commemoration is more than just history. And finally, you have this whole series of books which are oral history. These are a certain number of authors who specialise in this. Max Arthur is one of them. And what they did, fundamentally is that, well, there were a whole series of interviews of old people. This is interviews of old people. Max Arthur did it all. On different aspects. And this last one is rather interesting because this is what happened to you just after the war. What happened when you came home? Very, very interesting stories. And in particular, one of the most interesting things about it is that a very large number of men never told their story to their, even to their family. Yet silence was the normal thing. Which is, from one point of view, tremendously sad. That really couldn't say. But also, this was a society where the roles of men and women were very, very separate. And not telling the horrible stories to your wife, it was considered to be part of your duty as a man. And that was what was being a man, was not sharing horrific things with the woman. I just like to congratulate the men here. Congratulations on choosing the 21st century to live in, because this was no fun. Thank you very much for listening. I will see you next week. Watch out for the...